Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Okay. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event in association with Humanities West. It's my great pleasure to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences, and they're in for a great treat tonight because we have an actual string quartet here to play, not only to explain, but to play Russian art. Stephen Machtiger, my friend, who has been here four or five times already with his quartet, the San Joaquin Quartet, has now going to do a Borodin quartet and then a piece from Tchaikovsky. And he will explain a little bit about Borodin. And at the end of all the music, I will give my introduction to it for the reason that I said before. Thank you very much.
Once a musicologist was asked, "What is great music?" And his answer was, "Great music is music that is so great that it needs to be explained." So the bulk of our program tonight is a string quartet by Alexander Borodin. I'm just curious how many people had heard of Borodin before. Oh my, that's most people have raised their hands. I first became acquainted with Borodin when I was 13 years old and joined a youth orchestra, which was led by a Russian violinist who had brought with him from Russia stacks and stacks of orchestra music by Glinka, Borodin, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, et cetera, et cetera. He had studied with Leopold Auer, to whom the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto was dedicated. So you can see how quickly time collapses on itself. Borodin was born in 1833, the same year that Johannes Brahms was born in Germany, and 7 years before Tchaikovsky was born in Russia. Borodin was born to a Russian nobleman and a young woman who was not the nobleman's wife. Borodin's father didn't acknowledge him formally. In fact, he had him registered as a serf and the son of one of his serfs. But he put him up very nicely and paid for an education, which included cello lessons and science lessons. And Borodin wound up being a very famous chemist. He studied to be a doctor. He was a surgeon in the army, and he invented or discovered chemical reactions that are even today known in Russia as the Borodin reaction. I will not explain the chemical reaction to you because I don't know how to do that. Approximately 1862, Borodin became part of a group, almost a cult, of amateur musicians who gathered around Russian musician named Balakirov. And they were all amateurs, and a group was known as the Five, and it included, in addition to Balakirov and Borodin, Mussorgsky, Rimsky-Korsakov, and someone named Cesar Cui, whose music is not played today for reasons I don't know. Anyway, they set themselves up as Russian nationalists who were trying to establish a Russian school of music in opposition to the school of more European-oriented music that was led by Tchaikovsky and Nikolai and Anton Rubinstein. They were part of an international movement where composers all over Europe were trying to get to the roots of their national music. And so Borodin became friends with Liszt, who was famous for his Hungarian rhapsodies. And around this same time, we had composers in Spain, Albinez, Sibelius wrote Finlandia, Dvorak and his Slavonic dances. And they were trying to get to the heart of their own national character. And so there was very little chamber music or symphonies written by this group. because symphonies and chamber music were part of the European tradition, and what they were looking for was operas. And so Borodin wrote a famous work called Prince Igor, and you've heard some of that music perhaps in the show Kismet, and some of the other tunes from Kismet came from this quartet we're going to play. But Borodin was very independently minded, and in 1881, he composed a string quartet, which is considered one of the true gems of chamber music to come out of Russia. And since this is a Humanities West a program, I thought I'd let you know some of the other things that were going on in 1881. That was the year that Dostoevsky died. It was the year after Tolstoy wrote Anna Karenina. It was the year of the assassination of the Tsar Alexander II, which led to turmoil, reaction, and of course, as usual during times of trouble in Russia, pogroms against the Jews, who were falsely blamed for the assassination. And yet, in the middle of all this, Borodin was very calm, and he dedicated this quartet very lovingly to his wife. He was very happily married, and you can just see contentment and peace and love throughout this piece. The quartet is in four movements. The first is a straight classical sonata form movement with an exposition with three different themes, a development section, recapitulation where the tune comes in, and a coda, a very classic traditional form. The second movement is a scherzo, which is a fast dance movement in 3-4. The middle part of it is a waltz, and you can just almost smell the perfume. It's just so infused with Parisian or Viennese type of romanticism. The third movement is the most famous movement. It's the nocturne, and this is essentially a love song to his wife. And you will remember this tune because it's repeated many, many times throughout the movement in different combinations of different instruments with different accompaniments. The last movement is the most Russian of the four movements. It starts with a very strange, growling kind of slow introduction. And then you'll see that that actually outlines the fugal theme, which then follows, and it becomes kind of a Russian dance, not unlike what you hear in Tchaikovsky. If there's time permitting, we will follow it with a performance of the Tchaikovsky Andante Cantabile from his second string quartet. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So that was a look into Russian music. A little glimpse. Obviously, there's lots more. Most of it has this lush feeling to it. I think it's kind of a very important thing to think about because there's a big cultural argument today about no cultural appropriations. We can't appropriate anybody else's culture. And I think there's a difference between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation. Very similar, but you know, very, very different. And I think it's a mistake to take this so far that you say, for example, Tolstoy really was a man and therefore he should never have included any female characters in his novels because he really didn't know, you know, how to write about that. And there are a lot of other choices like that. And actually most cultures want you to appreciate their culture. They want their main events to be appreciated by you. I happened to get interested in Russian culture. I was following communism in high school a little bit. But in 1971, I got a brochure from my college that I was about to attend from the Russian department, which said that if you actually studied Russian for 2 years, you could go to the Soviet Union. And I know that doesn't sound like a really big good deal to go to the Soviet Union in 1973, but I was very intrigued by it. This was 1971, and those of you who are old enough, I mean, it was right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and everybody, even though we were only young, we kind of figured out that we were being lied to about the war. And so I began to wonder, you know, what else are we being lied to about? Are we being lied to about communism? So, you know, I wanted to do that. So I actually switched from Latin, which I was studying, and I knew unless I went back in time 2,000 years, I probably couldn't use very well anyway. So I switched to Russian. I studied it. I went to the Soviet Union in 73 for the summer. And ironically, I discovered that what we were being told about communism was not enough. It was worse than what was being said about it. We really didn't know how bad it was. It was so gray. And I knew with my mouth that I would never have made it to the age 25 in that culture. I would have been killed probably by the time I was a freshman in high school. I barely made it through a Catholic high school. You know, and I had the kind of tolerant Catholic high school, you know, run by Franciscans, not by Jesuits. You know, so it really, you know, was not my kind of culture from that point of view. But underneath this grayness of a collective idea, there was this lush Russian culture from the 19th century. And what was very interesting is that was part of something else that was tried, which was that the Russians, ever since it was started by Prince Rus, which is where Russia comes from, 1,000 years ago in Kiev. He was only there, he was a Scandinavian, he only came to protect the trade route on the way to the Middle East. They were bringing slaves down, mostly blonde women that they sold in the markets and some other things, and that was the trade route that they were protecting. They came down. The chronicles, the ancient chronicles from Russia, claim that he was invited there, but... People claim things about the number of people who come to their inauguration, all kinds of things. So we probably don't believe that about how he got there. But they did control that area, and that was the start, which is, I think, something for everybody to understand because the Russians consider Kiev to be the start of their thing. So it's a little problematic to just say, let it go, in spite of Queen Elsa. So if you look at that, and the first thing that Prince Rus did was he said, we have to make the Russian culture part of the European culture. I won't tell you a long story about it, but one of his first decisions was to go out and get a religion that was, you know, acceptable to the Europeans. And he had the Jews and the Islamic people and the Roman Catholics and the Greek Orthodox come and give him, you know, a little pep talk as to which one he should bring all of his people into. Now, we know the outcome, obviously, the Greek Orthodox won. But he decided that he didn't want to be Jewish because he didn't want to get circumcised. It was, you know, it was very, very simple. It was not really deep thinking here. He decided he liked pork too much to become Islamic. He was kind of attracted to Roman Catholics, but the Greek Orthodox came last, and the patriarch descended in a golden throne from the top of a dome of a cathedral while all kinds of gorgeous music was playing and stuff like that. And he said, that's what I want. You know, I want to be at the top of, oh, well, that's the wrong tower. Okay. So the gold and the way that he got pulled into it was an attraction to European culture. They wanted to be European. And Peter the Great in 1700 did the same thing. I'm going to say that Putin is doing the same thing, and we're missing the point of what he was doing. In 2014 in Sochi at the Winter Olympics, what did he do? He put on this big show, right? And a lot of people made fun of him for spending all that money, and he was teased for it and so on and so forth. He put on the big show. What was the big show? It was, look what Europeans, we Russians are. Look at this beautiful ballet we did. We took it from the French and made it better. You know, we took the European music, and we have our own, it's like a classical music with Russian characteristics. So we've done all this stuff. We've made this contribution to European culture. Why don't you do it? You know, it reminds me a lot of like if you have younger siblings, and you've always called them a baby, right? And they're 30, 35. They start to get a little impatient about this, right? And they say, when are you going to treat me like an adult? When are you going to treat me like part of the family? But of course, we almost never do. It's kind of one of the things we do. A very similar thing that we did was to the Japanese. In the 1850s, we sent Commodore Perry there, opened him up, said, you can't just hide from us anymore. You have to open up to trade. We're making the whole world a free trade place, so you guys have to cooperate. And there was an internal struggle in Japan over that. But the winning side adopted the military strategics of the West and therefore won against the samurai. And then they went in and they said, okay, now we're going to be like Europeans. We're going to do this. And we did that. And then we industrialized and everything was successful. And then they said, okay, now we want to do the next step. We want to colonize other places. And then we said, no, you can't do that. You can do what you did, but you can't do that, right? And obviously, it's very frustrating experience for the Japanese. Now we're doing the same thing, I think, to the Russians again. You know, we said, get rid of communism. You know, Gorbachev, listen, you know, communism came to an end. We sent in Goldman Sachs. You know, Goldman Sachs said, do it this way. They did it that way. Their whole economy collapsed. You know, their money disappeared and everything like that. And then they went back to authoritarian ways to try to put it back together again. And we said, how dare you do that? You know, we in America, we would never, no American president would ever, ever do anything authoritarian. So we know that you ought not to do this. So in thinking about this, I think it's very important to say, where are we headed? We are headed, and we know we're headed there, to a democratic future for the human race, right? And how are we going to get there? We certainly aren't going to get there by having a jihad for democracy. That will just slow us down because it's not effective. And, you know, we probably, the best thing to do is become democratic here in the United States first. You know, cut out the gerrymandering, cut out this, cut out the other things so that people can see what you know, democracy can really do. But it really is an ancient movement in human culture away from authoritarian solutions, which has been 95% of everything that has been done, right? To a democratic solution where the individual has rights and not the collective. So we have this cultural appreciation for what everybody has done, and educated people across the world love parts of, you know, the Russian culture, parts of the French culture, parts of the German culture. We don't like all the stuff that they did for any culture. And the Chinese, you know, it's very interesting, you know, that people are aware in classical music, a lot of the top artists are Chinese nationals now. How did that happen? We had a speaker here at the Commonwealth Club 2, 3, 4 years ago that told the story. And it was actually a very interesting, totally, you know, random, almost random thing. After the communists went Chinese, they wanted to, you know, inspire their people to great and heroic activities. And one of the people they chose to do that was Beethoven, because he was deaf and he still did what he did in classical music. And so they had this story about Beethoven that was kind of a children's book and passed around and stuff like that. Little did they know, it created an entire generation fascinated with classical music from Europe. And this is where it came from. And the Russian story is very similar. The Russians, aristocratic society in 1800 or so, decided they wanted to be as Europeanly acceptable as possible again. And this time it wasn't picking a religion. It was, let's outdo them at their own art. Let's outdo them at music. Let's do them at art. Let's, you know, have writers and so on and so forth. But I don't think there were schools for the writers. But they created schools for classical music and schools for ballet and so on and so forth. And This eventually created in 60 or 70 years generations, like the third generation, that then made these huge contributions at the end. So it's a very important thing to understand how this, because this is where we're going. We're going to the future. And I rarely quote scripture. But I thought I would end this sort of, you know, where we're going on a very high biblical note. So in our transition, in humanity's transition to democracy, let he who is without authoritarianism cast the first drone. So we have time for questions of the musicians and about the music. There's lots and lots of information about Borodin, or the last piece on Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky also a very interesting character, and how he got started. So if you'd like to ask any questions, or if you would like to demand some kind of, you know, replay of the Tchaikovsky or something like that, I kind of understand that. So who would like to ask the first question or make the first demand? Okay.
No, I would just like to make a comment. It was most enjoyable. Thank you very much for coming.
So you guys are so great. Where do you perform?
Many places. Maybe, have you ever heard of the Freeway Philharmonic? Who wants to talk about the Freeway Philharmonic? There are a lot of regional orchestras in the Bay Area, and the musicians in the San Francisco Symphony pretty much stay put and teach and have a very settled life. But for everyone else, there's the Marin Symphony, the San Jose Symphony, the Sacramento Symphony, the Santa Cruz Symphony, the Modesto Symphony, and more. There's actually a documentary that was premiered at the Mill Valley Film Festival called The Freeway Philharmonic, and you can probably find it on Netflix. But it follows some of our colleagues spending most of their time, of course, in the car. And they travel from community to community. It's a core. And the Bay Area, we're just very lucky to have such a pool of very talented musicians who want to live here and an audience that loves classical music. So all over the Bay Area, there are concerts popping up. And this particular group, we've never actually performed together in this configuration. Luella, I should introduce the musicians. Anna Washburn is our first violinist. Monica Gruber is our second violinist. And Luella Hausboon is our cellist. And Luella and I have played together for many decades. We've been playing with Anna for several years now. And Monica joined us for this concert, and we hope to play again together at the first opportunity.
So there's time for one or two more questions. Oh, great. Okay. Who wants them? Okay.
I just have a question about the fourth movement. I kind of felt the whole flow, you know, through the first three movements. And then the fourth movement just seems so very different. And I wondered if it seemed that way to any of you.
That was my reaction the first time I heard it. The fourth movement is very strange. But the more we played it, the more we found, I can speak for myself, but I'd be interested in the other musicians. There are sections in it that tie it to the other movements. It alternates between this kind of crazy fugal dance, but then there are more lyrical sections. Borodin had an incredible gift for melody and harmony. But the last movement was tough. And he keeps stopping it and playing that strange, slow, growling Russian bear. That happens three times in the movement, and then you get it going again. So that one took the most work, and it's still a work in progress, I think.
It's been a joy to hear you again. Thank you so much. I'm a little jealous because I wish I could play like you. I was very interested to know how this then became a popular entity with the great musical Kismet.
Okay.
Would anyone like to answer that question? In the early 50s, someone had decided to... I think that was the premiere of it as a Broadway play, as a musical, and they just stole from Borodin the music, and they took sections from the string quartet and also sections from the Polovetsian dances, which have a very famous Stranger in Paradise, I think was the name of the song from the musical, and then it's been made into a movie a couple of times. But this music just begs to be heard and listened to and played, and I really can't blame the producers for stealing it.
It's called Kismet. Kismet. They probably figured that not so many people had heard it before because it was Russian, maybe, and so they could get away with it. Last question, anybody? Okay. Yeah.
So, first of all, I just think your playing is beautiful. And I also just want to share that I'm a teacher at a public middle school here in San Francisco. And I teach at Francisco Middle School. I teach music. And I came to hear two of our coaches, Monica Gruber and Luella Hasbin, are coaches at our school through the San Francisco Symphony Education Department. And as I was listening, I was just so grateful that our students get to work with artists like you and get to be inspired by not only your wonderful playing, but your wonderful teaching. So thank you. I appreciate it so much.
Which is a perfect place to end another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very, very much. So I have a couple of post announcements to make. First of all, this is, like, as I said before, the fifth time, and I just wanted to point out one fact that I didn't want to say on the recording about Steve, but, you know, Borodin here was, as you said, an amateur musician. You know, obviously, as an amateur, he wrote this kind of music. He was a chemist. Steve is and I met way over a decade, almost two decades ago, doing our legal work. He's also a lawyer. And so I think it's very important, I think, as culture moves forward, that people do jobs, and do art at the same time, because obviously it adds to the culture tremendously. And the other thing is that Humanities West, another organization here in San Francisco, is putting on a two-day program about the Russian artists Friday and Saturday this weekend. And it is at the Marines Memorial Theater. And tomorrow night, Robert Greenberg, for those of you who know, he's the guy in the teaching company who does all the music appreciation stuff. He's going to be speaking about how the Russians went from zero to Tchaikovsky in 100 years in the 19th century. What was their plan and everything, and playing music. That's tomorrow night. And then on Saturday, we're going to be having lectures about Pushkin and about Dostoevsky, and then about the artists, the painting artists. So we're going to cover all of Russian culture this weekend for anyone who's interested. So thank you very much. That's at the Marine. No, it's not here. It's at Marines Memorial Theater. And there are still tickets available. So if you just show up, you can buy them right there at the when you show. Any questions before we go?
What time?
Oh, yeah, Friday night it starts at 7:30, goes till about 9:45. And Saturday starts at 10 o'clock in the morning, goes till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Anything else? Great. Thanks for coming.